at a major speech in Russia yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin made no uncertain terms a declaration that we are possibly seeing the early stages of an escalation of the war, not just an escalation with Ukraine and Russia, but potentially outside of it. And the threat and the risks continue to grow. And especially in light of comments made by the United States this week about the more on what the Department of War is and more escalation in that regard, even domestically and internationally in other spheres, there is a complete concern, or there should be a concern, that things are moving in a bad direction, both for American national security and for global peace and stability. To try and make some sense out of this, we have back with us today one of our favorites, Patrick Henningsen, host of Sunday Wire, patrickhenningsen.substack.com, and just all-around cool guy, man. That's a really good look for you, by the way. I like that black and everything.
Yeah, cheers, Daniel. It's great to be with you.
And so I know you're coming with us from Marseille, France today, a little bit different background. That looks really cool. I guess you got some business down there in the south of France.
That's right. Yeah, we're down here and working on a pretty big story, a couple of big stories. And I'm just pleased and privileged to be working with such great journalists here in Europe.
Very good. And when can people expect to see that on, I guess, your Sunday Wire?
It would be on 21stCenturyWire.com. We've already released various chunks of it, but it's right up there. It'll be on our feature section in the next couple of weeks.
Very good. We recommend people to go see that. But after our show, don't go just quite yet, because we've got a lot of things to discuss today. Now, listen, the primary thing we had set up for this show is to talk about the renaming of the Department of Defense to the Department of War, what some of the ramifications that means. This conversation earlier this week where Secretary of Now War Hegseth basically lectured all of America's senior commanding generals, et cetera. And then now this idea that maybe we're going to expand things a little bit. There's the Tomahawk missile has entered the conversation here, and Vladimir Putin talked about a lot of that. But before we get into that, some news that was breaking just right before we came on the air here that I want to get your reaction to, because it's an even bigger troubling sign to me, especially in combination with all these other things. And that is Secretary of War Pete Hegseth released a post on X saying, earlier this morning on President Trump's order, I directed a lethal kinetic strike on narco trafficking vessel affiliated with designated terrorist organization in the U.S. Southcom area of responsibility. Four male narco terrorists aboard the vessel were killed in the strike and no U.S. forces were harmed. The strike was conducted in international waters just off the coast of Venezuela while the vessel was transporting substantial amounts of narcotics headed to America to poison our people. And then he answers the question that a lot of people would then have, which I think he believes will just silence any of the questions after that, which he says, our intelligence, without a doubt, confirmed that this vessel was trafficking narcotics. The people on board were narco terrorists, and they were operating on a known narco trafficking transit route. These strikes will continue until the attacks on the American people are over. So let me just ask you, first of all, there is no legal justification either in the United States or international law to allow anyone, international waters or not, this just needs to be stated point blank, that will allow any country to just unilaterally declare someone to be a terrorist and go after them and kill them without even making an attempt to interdict the boat. What do you think of this?
Well, it's bad precedent, Daniel. It's no due process. No evidence required. So you just basically, find a target. The executive says, they're guilty. The executive labels them terrorist and they take, unilateral action with no prejudice or extreme prejudice. Sorry. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the problem is within the global war on terror, a lot of precedents were set. And a lot of power was devolved to the executive branch with JSOC through the Bush administrations, through the Obama administrations, and what Trump and Biden and Trump, what they've inherited is an incredible concentration of power. And no real due process is necessary. Like Anwar al-Awlaki, for instance, a lot was made about Obama's drone strike against the supposed Al-Qaeda deputy and recruiter there, but you know, very little in terms of our mainstream media investigative journalism was done to look at the relationship between Al-Awlaki and our intelligence services and the Pentagon itself. And the links are quite strong, but that was, it was all about, oh, well, Obama's droned this American citizen, this dual citizen or American citizen who is with Al-Qaeda. But the precedent was set nonetheless. The problem with the Venezuela narrative is, listen, if you've been studying the war on drugs, or you've been studying from Gary Webb's work in the late 80s and 90s, early 90s, right through to the present day, you will know the biggest drug dealers in our hemisphere are the DEA and the CIA. So, I mean, that's not like a secret or anything. Working together with the cartels and flooding U.S. streets with narcotics, various forms of narcotics, certain amount of narcotics and a large amount coming through legal ports of entry, in fact, not coming by like speedboats from Venezuela. It's utterly ridiculous. So, I mean, what they're trying to do is create a narrative and set a precedent, and you'll hear this narrative as well. China's putting fentanyl on our streets. China's somehow trafficking fentanyl in order to kill or make turn American citizens into drug addicts, okay? And very little is said as to the reason why drug use is up, you know, why the prices are so cheap, and so forth. There's reasons for all of these things, why the supply is so high, why they have such an appeal in today's America. There's a lot of good reasons for that, none of which will be addressed. None of those details, none of that in terms of realizations, inquiry, it's not going to happen. Instead, you have this thing that's being constructed purely for geopolitical reasons to demonize Venezuela. They're setting the ground for regime change. You have to remember, first Trump administration, you had two failed coups against Venezuela. It was hugely embarrassing. And, you know, the likes of John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Mike Pence was front running that. And, you know, I thought J.D. Vance was going to be Trump's intelligent better half when he appointed him as vice president. I thought it was going to be the high IQ part of the equation that would temper and sort of help Trump with national security issues. But what you have now is J.D. Vance has turned into Mike Pence. Yeah. So totally clueless, completely captured by special interests, by the Israeli lobby in Washington, and totally useless, not a counterbalance to anything. In fact, J.D. Vance is helping to talk up escalation with Ukraine and all of these things that we just hoped. And we these are the reasons why many people voted for Donald Trump, that they were going to get something different from the previous administrations. And instead, they've got the same. So this continuity,
and you know, and I would even argue that in some regards it's worse here. And you mentioned something about precedents. I want to go down that rabbit hole for just a second, because I think it's really important and could lay the foundation for other things to come later. And that is, you know, during the post 2003 time, where we had the authorization for the use of military force, the AUMFs, which were just exploited and used mercilessly, wildly out of proportion to anything that was ever written in them, especially by the Obama administration. They cited everything. Bush before that did it to basically justify anything, however thin, but they had on to that. Well, now then you have this case to where President Trump simply merely issued an edict and said that we are now at war against narco-terrorists. He then unilaterally declares this. And so now then he is using that justification to justify these extrajudicial killings. And he uses that as some sort of legal justification. There is none, but yet that's the way it's being presented, that this is legal, it's lawful, and it's keeping America safe or so. And I worry about if that's the case now, and nobody, whether Republican or Democrat, House or Senate, nobody's standing up against this and calling this out for what it is. It seems to me, you used, I think, the term emboldened a minute ago. If this is not stopped, it won't stay the same. It will continue to expand and go into other areas. And this will literally be a government, I think, especially the military, that's just run by caveat from the executive office.
And the other thing this does is this is basically trying to give some credence to the narrative that Nicolas Maduro's so-called regime in Venezuela he's a narco king, and he's the head of the Venezuelan government, and they're holding it by force. We're still recognizing some other president, somebody who isn't even elected to anything. Like Juan Guaido, there's a new Juan Guaido now recognized by Washington. U.S. will continue to try to steal state assets as they did in the previous administration, stealing Citgo and Citgo assets and redistribute them to Juan Guaido and other glad-handed deals with the wealthy Venezuelan diaspora in the United States, you know, shutting down embassies in Washington. I mean, that, all those things happened in the previous administrations, and it's there's no evidence to show instead of dealing with the actual drug cartels, the actual, you know, people that are profiting from human trafficking, from narcotics that are based in Mexico, Guatemala, and the other Central American countries, and that the fact that this is an international operation, and the fact that there's other countries, including U.S. allies, that are involved in this trade. I'll leave it there. You can use your imagination, but illegal weapons, the terrorism, drugs, and so forth. They're not addressing any of that. Instead, they're creating a fictitious phantom menace in Venezuela in order to justify sanctions, and also to just put on this show for the Fox News audience that they're doing something. It's
yeah, and Gary, like, put that headline back up there if you would. The one I want, because that what it says here is that President Trump just declared we are in an armed conflict with drug cartel. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, and maybe it's an old fashioned document, there's this thing called the United States Constitution, which exclusively and irrevocably puts that authorization and power into the hands of the legislative body. Now, I don't think that I have, unless I missed something, that the Congress declared war on the cartels in any way, shape, or form. So here we just have the executive in direct contradiction to the separation of powers declaring it so. But again, where is Congress, whether Republican or Democrat? Because this is their power that is being blatantly taken right before our eyes.
And that those of us who were pushing back against the authorization for the use of military force, pushing back against the NDAA for decades. And the reason was because of the principle of it. It was fine because the Bush administration, you have Dick Cheney and you have these old Washington stalwarts that, you know, served right back to the Nixon administration in the Bush Jr. Years. And then under Obama, you have John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, and they finessed all of these operations through this really sophisticated public relations machine and messaging. And they could do covert operations, but just doing it under the table and, you know, doing a lot of illegal proxy wars under Obama. And the first Trump administration, he tried a few of these, totally ham-fisted, failed miserably. And then Biden, it's very similar to the Obama administration, same staff, same personnel. But now the second Trump administration, you have all these executive tools, all of these extrajudicial tools, these end runs around Congress, and you have a very unstable chief executive who is very... I think doesn't have the intellectual capacity to articulate policy, not credibly anyway, to the public or to the global international community, and then surrounded by people that they don't look like they're really credible and highly skilled and experienced in these areas. And you've given all the tools, you've given the keys to the arsenal, if you will, to a lot of amateurs. And then you have the head of the Pentagon, effectively, who's talking like he's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Pete Hegseth, who's a weekend Fox News host, who his highest rank, I think, was major. He's a platoon leader. He's sitting there lecturing all the top brass in the U.S. military. He said, when I was a platoon leader, that's what I wanted. That's all I ever asked for. So it's bizarre. And it's almost like, I don't know, I can't imagine what the humiliation it must be for somebody who worked their way up to be a general through the U.S. military structure to get a dressing down from a hothead who is a Fox Weekend host who doesn't have any qualifications at all, nothing rising to the level of the job he's been given, simply because he was a Trump ally and because the Israeli lobby said he is an Israeli lobbyist. We want him in that position. And he's young and malleable. But it's a disaster. And I don't know where to start with. I mean, we're not even talking about the talk of deploying troops in U.S. cities to fight crime and do target practice against U.S. criminals in cities. I mean, this is insane.
Yeah, which is what President Trump said just a couple of days ago. But speaking of Hegseth and what he's gone down, now he is now overall the Department of War, which has been renamed from the Department of Defense. And that is now starting to take on more than just rhetorical significance. And it's getting noticed by our potential adversaries, notably one Vladimir Putin, who yesterday at the Valdai conference addressed the issue and was asked about the Department of War issue.
Our interlocutors and your interlocutor across the ocean recently renamed the Ministry of Defense into the Ministry of War. It would seem to be the same thing, but as they say, there is a nuance. Do you think that names matter in essence? Well, one can say no, but one can also say that as you name the ship, so it will sail. There is probably some meaning in this, but it sounds somewhat aggressive. Ministry of War. We have a Ministry of Defense. We have always proceeded from this. Proceed from it now, and we'll proceed from it in the future. We have no aggressive intentions toward third countries. We have a Ministry of Defense, and the goal of the Ministry of Defense is to ensure the security of the Russian state and the peoples of the Russian Federation.
Okay, that's supposed to be something close to the definition for the armed forces of every country on the planet, to take after their defense, to look after their security so that nobody can attack them or something. That's, you can nearly say that should be everyone, but now ours are not, because we've changed it. Now, it's not just the change of the word from defense to war, but when President Trump announced this for the first time in the Oval Office, he expressly said, you know, I don't want to be on defense all the time. I want to go on offense. I want to do offensively. And then earlier this week on Tuesday, Secretary of War Hegseth put some details behind what that means.
To ensure peace, we must prepare for war. From this moment forward, the only mission of the newly restored Department of War is this: war fighting, preparing for war and preparing to win, unrelenting and uncompromising in that pursuit. Thus, the only people who actually deserve peace are those who are willing to wage war to defend it. That's why pacifism is so naive and dangerous. It ignores human nature and it ignores human history. Either you protect your people and your sovereignty, or you will be subservient to something or someone.
So a couple of things I want to ask your opinion on here, but let's start with one of those toward the back end there, is that you will be subservient if you're a pacifist. Has anyone in the Department of American Defense prior to this ever been accused of being pacifist?
So who's attacking America, Pete? Secretary Pete, who's attacked America? Nobody's attacked America, but America's attacked everybody else. And worse, America's attacked everybody else on behalf of a foreign country in the Middle East, Israel. And America is waging a proxy war on behalf of who? We don't know for sure. Maybe the military-industrial complex, maybe BlackRock. It's unclear what the Ukrainian endgame is on behalf of the British. It's unclear what the U.S. interests are in the proxy war in Ukraine. So what on earth is he talking about? Is he trying to rev up the narrative to expand the Pacific front against China? Is that what this is about? It's hard to tell. You know, if war fighting, I hear this a lot from Pete Hegseth, our warriors, our war fighters. What experience does Pete Hegseth have fighting wars? He was a guard at Gitmo. That's one of his big assignments as a reservist, a major. He was a guard at Gitmo for a while. He did apparently a couple of tours in Afghanistan against a bunch of goat herders with sandals. I mean, the Taliban weren't exactly a modern military, well equipped and well funded, were they? I mean, they really weren't. Unless I missed something, maybe he saw something we didn't. But that's the extent of Pete Hegseth's experience, and he's advocating for World War III. Let's not mince words. That type of talk with the type of weapons that the United States has, with the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, that's what that talk means. It's about being aggressive. It's about instigating conflict. It's about provoking other powers. That's what that that's what he is talking about.
Well, and in fact, that's where I wanted to go next, because one of the things he mocked anyone who was against this renaming going to Department of War was because it ignores human nature. And I think a pretty strong case can be made that he is ignoring human nature, because when you turn aggressive like this and you change the name, and Putin said in his commentary, he said, you know, a name is one thing, but when you see name followed by action, sometimes that tells you more than otherwise is the case. And then when you look at, Gary put up that head on, these are just a number of headlines from the last few months here. And all of these in light of the U.S. changing its name to the Department of War. We don't taking military power off the table for Panama, for Greenland. We've threatened and then actually did attack Iran. We've now determined that the U.S. is at war with the drug cartels. We earlier on, Trump expressly refused to rule out military action against Canada, for crying out loud, still has Mexico on the crosshairs. And as you mentioned a minute ago, is possibly looking at doing something against Maduro in Venezuela. And when you look at all those on top of what we're doing now, kind of starting to ramp things up in the Ukraine war, continuing to go down the path of supporting the Israelis in the Middle East. I mean, gracious, that says more than just some name on a nameplate, don't you think?
Well, it is. And the most disturbing thing that he said, you probably have the clip in your archive, Daniel, but he said these stupid rules of engagement that are, you know, got our hands tied. We're going to untie the hands of our war fighters and get rid of the rules of engagement. You know where that leads. There's rules of engagement for a reason.
Very good reason.
So does that mean all of the tradition of military rules of engagement, ethics, logical planning, international relations, because there's politics tied up into this.
And when law, you start international law,
U.S. domestic law. So you're going to throw all of that out the window because somehow you have arrived from Fox News and you know better than the previous, few millennia of human history. You supposedly know better. And Trump knows better, of course, because he is all seeing and all knowing. I mean, this is just insane. What he's talking about there is he's taking a Platonist position. He's talking about, he's giving, if you translated his speech into German, okay, and he's like, he's not just quoting Nietzsche and the will to power. That could easily be dropped into an Adolf Hitler midnight rally at Nuremberg. If you translate it into Italian, it would be Mussolini, exactly the same tone, exactly the same words, and completely based and hollow and devoid of any nuance or meaning or any really insight or understanding. It's pure fascism. And what's shocking about this, Daniel, isn't the fact that it's coming from the Trump administration. It's to the fact that Democrats are so paralytic that they can't vocalize any opposition to this. Yep. And it makes me think, is this what the Democrats want in Washington? Because I can tell you right now, it's definitely not what the people want in America. But I think people are so clueless and still in shock, and they're almost ignoring. This is like a TV show for a lot of Americans. And it hasn't really sunk in. It will sink in, though. It will sink in when you start ditch the rules of engagement and you start sending Tomahawk missiles that are nuclear capable. I mean, the Russians don't know if it's got a warhead on it or not. I mean, that's the what they're wading into here. So yeah. So let's talk about
the rules. I'm going to get to that the Tomahawk issue in a minute, but let me draw another line between what Hegseth said there, what President Trump has said, because if you're basically mocking everything, you're saying that rules of engagement heretofore have been too politically correct. And then you have the president of the United States say that Russia is actually just a paper tiger, meaning that maybe we can push the lines a little bit longer. Well, at this Valdai conference, President Putin was asked about that issue.
And he is teasing, saying that it is a paper tiger. A paper tiger? I already said that Russia all these years has been fighting not with the armed forces of Ukraine, not with Ukraine, but practically with all the NATO countries. And everywhere the Russian troops are confidently, I want to emphasize this, holding the strategic initiative. But if we are fighting against the whole NATO bloc and are still moving, advancing, feeling confident, and this is a paper tiger, then what is NATO itself? What does it then represent?
Is that a fair argument that you say that we're a paper tiger, but yet for the last nearly 2 years now, we've been on a methodical move forward and we have this strategic advantage and you have not been able to turn it off anywhere. So what does that say about us?
Well, what he's saying, the subtext to what Vladimir Putin is saying there, and he's a very erudite, very articulate. He's a lawyer by trade, so he's very good at forming arguments, and he's good at making the point without being over the top about it. And the subtle point he's making there, the subtext he's making there, is that 3 years in, the Europeans, the West, the United States, Canada, and everybody else, all the NATO confab, they're not willing to sacrifice one man, at least not, you know, in public, one soldier for this grand mission to weaken Russia. But they're more than happy, and it's a feckless and corrupt and underhanded and sort of cowardly way to use like a large portion of the able-bodied Ukrainian male population in order to achieve this vanity victory for Western hegemony and NATO. I mean, that's what Putin is really saying, but he's doing it in the most polite and strategic possible way. But that's what he means. He means NATO's not willing to put their money where their mouth is when it comes to war, but they're more than happy to chuck the whole of Ukraine into a wood chipper and see what happens, and maybe just sort of walk away from it after 5 years while they all got rich in the process. And then make up some other crisis and some other situation in order to keep, like Moldova, for instance, which they're working on, or Georgia, or the Baltic states, some sort of standoff there in order to keep the game going. That's kind of what Putin is saying there. But meanwhile, what's happening is, I think they are up in the ante, and that's the thing. They're up in the ante, and who's to say who comes next, Daniel? Who comes next after Trump? Who comes next after Merz? I mean, you might have people with somewhat unstable or fascist tendencies now, but what are you going to have in 5 years when the populist right sweeps into power in Europe? I mean, what sort of irrational thinking and rhetoric might you have then? Where might we be taken to then? It's unclear.
Yeah, it is unclear. But what is more clear is, President Putin went on to talk about how one of the other things, aside from all the military support that NATO and the West has given to Ukraine, it's also on the economic front that we have tried to crush Russia. You know, famously, President Biden, when he came into office, especially after the war started in 2022, he just said, you know, we're going to crush your economy. We're going to devastate it, destroy the ruble, and you're going to collapse, and you're not even going to be able to continue to wage the war. And to that, Putin responded with this.
Despite all attempts to corrode our Russian society from within, our opponents are achieving no result. But on the contrary, they are getting the effect opposite to what they expected. And the fact that young people have such an internal protection from any attempts to influence public consciousness from within, this is very good. This speaks to the maturity and solidity of Russian society.
So what do you think about that? I mean, is that just Putin trying to put a good face on it? Because, you know, we've been saturated in the Western media over the last couple of weeks, especially that the Russian economy is teetering. It's on the edge, that Putin is worried about holding on to power, that people are getting unhappy at home, et cetera. So which is right?
Well, it's really interesting. And if you trace back to Trump's pivot on Ukraine, it came right after his state visit to the UK, to Britain. And Britain's really been making this case that Ukraine is actually doing much better than it is in the fighting, that Russia's been, you know, it's on its back heels, it's on its knees, that Russia's just very close to just being, you know, the regime is very close to being delegitimized, the economy is very close to collapsing. Of course, they've been saying that for 2 or 3 years. And then the Americans usually adopt this same strident rhetoric. And I think he was sold this narrative, resold it during his trip to the UK. And British intelligence probably showed Donald Trump some facts, some figures, maybe a PowerPoint presentation, who knows, or somebody who he really respects or has, you know, admiration for, delivered the line to him that we just need to hang in there a little bit longer, Donald. Look at all this drone tech that we have. We are going to swarm the Russians with this new drone tech. Operation Spider's Web was nothing. Wait till you see what we've got next. Now, they have been hitting refineries in Russia. The number of Russian refineries have been taken offline because of drone attacks from Ukraine. But you know what? You know where this is going to lead. At some point, there is a breaking point that Russia has where they're saying, okay, at that point, we're going to take out the entirety of Ukraine's fuel infrastructure. We're going to put you into fuel poverty if you continue this, and then we'll see what happens on the battlefield. That's where it's headed. And that level of escalation, when you start getting into that level of escalation, or they start then, Ukraine starts hitting deep into Russian territory or using attackums or God forbid, Tomahawks, Storm Shadows and whatnot, then it's going to be, and Russia has said, we're going to retaliate and hit the source of the threat. The source of the threat, if it's in Romania, if it's in Poland, if it's somewhere in Europe or even in NATO territory, as they like to call it. They like to call it NATO territory, as Jan Stoltenberg famously coined. Then what? Then what? Then we're going to be dragged into, they could drag us into Transnistria and Moldova. All they have to do is stage some kind of a provocation to draw Ukraine into Transnistria. And then all of a sudden, the whole thing is inflamed again. And that's one thing we've been warning about. We filed some really good reports on this topic maybe a couple weeks ago. And we're warning about what might happen after the elections in Moldova if Maia Sandu wins, the pro-EU, pro-NATO candidate. And of course, she did. And so now we have the scene is set for potentially another front being opened up here. And that would be the mechanism by which Zelensky would then go back to Washington and the press. You can imagine the free-for-all and the chest puffing and backslapping when the press and the entire bureaucratic elite in the West get behind this new front in Moldova, then they're going to be the money, the weapons, give Zelensky whatever he needs. And we're going to be back to 2022 again. And so, and then how long is that going to last at that point? And what will be the cost of that? Where is it going to lead us? So, I mean, that's the danger of escalation is you could easily open up one or two more fronts in this conflict.
And along those same lines, we were talking about the economic warfare against Russia, which Putin said there, you know, we've completely weathered and we haven't collapsed from that. But one of our viewers here, Roman O, he says, everybody knows I'm all for Russia, but the sanctions are working in some ways. Mm. Obviously, he would say that in public, but me personally, I'm actually seeing it in reality. Is there a risk there that if the sanctions and all these things that we're doing actually start to really bite hard and actually hurt the Russian war effort, then that also could spawn a reaction of some sort that could accelerate on the battlefield?
Yeah, it could, and it most likely will. But I'll tell you this about the Russians. They're highly adaptable. And if you think, look what they've done in economically, weathering the largest raft of sanctions in the history of sanctions since 2022, even before that, since 2014. So what they could do, all sorts of things. They could get into trading refined fuel with other countries, and then, you know, Ukraine would have to attack another country in order to stop the refinement process. I mean, there's a lot of things Russia can do. They have the resources, they have the raw material in the form of oil and natural gas. They can trade, so they have a lot. They will adapt. Russia will adapt and overcome. They have the capability to do that. Ukraine doesn't, and quite frankly, Europe and NATO don't. They don't have that level of adaptivity because their hands are tied with a completely fake and inflated economy with the relative purchasing power parity that are, you know, that makes things, you know, not affordable, makes nothing affordable in the West. But a lot of the things that the West are paying a fortune for are very cheap and doable on the Russian side because they just have a better economy, and the state has a bigger hand in a lot of industries in Russia. So they're not driven by shareholder dividends. So it's a different equation.
So let's look at one other thing that's been in the news here lately, which could also potentially cause an escalation, and that is the potential use of the Tomahawk missile. We showed earlier, I think it was on Sunday, that the vice president publicly acknowledged that Zelensky had specifically asked for the Tomahawk missile. And for those who may not know, the Tomahawk missile, cruise missile, is something the United States has. It is nuclear capable. I think you mentioned that a minute ago. So it's a big risk just on its own merit, because if it's used, it's unclear. The radar signature doesn't know the difference between conventional or nuclear warheads, et cetera. That's one problem. The range is also substantially longer. Some versions go up to 1,500 miles, which is like 7 or 8 times longer than the ATACMS long-range missiles that we've already given them. So that could potentially, just on the numbers alone, could cause a problem. The vice president said, when asked, will we give it to him? He said, well, that's a decision the president's going to make. We'll see what's going to happen with that. Well, yesterday, Volodymyr Zelensky had kind of a coy comment when he was asked, where are we on the cruise missile issue?
Before this moment, we used on long distance targets, we used only our weapon, as you know. And after my meeting with President of the United States, yes, we will maybe have something more. I don't know. We'll see.
That little smirk there at the end, and you could see that he was in the middle of talking, and then he's like, oh, wait, I better not say that. I almost wonder if we're not going to give him some of those, or at least we told him we might. How do you read that?
First of all, he looked very disheveled and just completely wrecked, firstly. But he apparently has been promised or has knowledge of something. So, but you know, we're back to the wonder weapons, Daniel, and they really believe that that's going to somehow change the tide of this battle. And Donald Trump himself said some incredible, outrageous things in the last couple of weeks that Ukraine, we're going to retake all of the Donbass regions for Ukraine and then go even further. What does he mean? Does he mean Crimea? Does he mean the Kursk region? Are they going to take Belgorod? I mean, what is he talking about? So, I mean, that alone is really reckless talk by the U.S. president, but it's typically vague with Trump. So I don't know whether to take all of that too seriously, because a lot of things have been promised under Trump in the last 9 months have not been delivered. A lot of the things that Zelensky was promised, a lot of things, threats he made, haven't come true. So they will continue to suffer. They will continue to struggle to get enough manpower to man the front lines as where they currently are in the conflict. That equation is not going to get any better for Ukraine, and Russia will continue to mobilize their society, their economy, and their industry. So I just don't see how, unless it's about provoking Russia to hit back in a way that will elicit some kind of a grand response and grand summit and collaboration and coalition by the West, i.e. World War III.
That we are not anywhere near prepared for that. So that would be a catastrophic bad calculation for us. But we don't have to wonder what the Russians think about this, because yesterday at Valdai, Vladimir Putin also addressed the Tomahawk issue.
Will this pose damage to our relations, where we see light at the end of the tunnel? Of course, using Tomahawks without direct involvement of the U.S. officers is impossible, which means a brand new stage of escalation, even between Russia and the U.S.
So he was referencing there that and Russia has really, all the way through since Trump got inaugurated, had, despite the differences, Putin often says, well, at least we have a negotiating partner in the United States. And I'm hopeful that because we're talking, whether it's Trump personally, personal meetings, phone calls, Steve Witkoff, et cetera. So he says that's all good and we can have work toward these things, et cetera. But now he's saying that there's a limit to that. And if you do these kinds of things, then now that even our own relation comes into question. Is that something you're concerned about?
Well, I mean, I was concerned when Kellogg was popping off, threatening to hit targets deep inside Russian territory just a week and a half ago. And J.D. Vance was sort of backing that up in a certain way. That's the vice president. So, but there's no discipline. This is the problem, is there on the U.S. side, there's no discipline or consistency. And that's a big problem. And I think it might even be their undoing in the end. So it's, I'm not worried because so much currency is put on the Trump administration in talk and making a big show and making big announcements and doing big sort of, you know, public relations splashes like the Alaska summit, ditto for the threats. But what are they actually prepared to do, you know, physically, in terms of making good on those threats? It's not clear. It's really not clear. You can't just make the problem with Trump is, and people in this Trump style of negotiations is he really believes, at least his people believe, they're putting on a strong front, a show of force, and that if they make threats, that it increases their leverage in negotiations because we're America and we're strong. That's what I think they believe. But that goes against, again, thousands of years of academic and study and understanding of the of war, peace, negotiations of von Clausewitz. It goes against all of that.
Well, and
it's almost like they want to reinvent.
Specifically on this issue here, because if you're going to make a threat for something, it's got to be a valid one. Yet Jennifer Kavanaugh, who, by the way, we're going to have her on the show here in about 15 minutes, as it turns out. But she wrote something on the about the Tomahawk missiles that I thought it's very important to bring up during your show here, because she said, look, there's some very practical problems here. Gary, if you could pull that full screen up there, the one. Yeah, that's the one. She said the Tomahawk missiles can be fired in three ways: from a guided missile destroyer, from Ohio, Virginia, Los Angeles class submarines, and using a new ground-based Typhoon system, which was developed by the U.S. Army. Ukraine does not have any of these capabilities. Thus, it kind of suggests what Putin said there, is that if they're ever used, then it's with the direct participation of the United States. And I don't think even Trump is going to want to get into a direct war with Russia over something that won't change, won't even affect the outcome on the tactical front. What do you think of that?
No, it's very similar to the Storm Shadow missiles as well. There's multiple ways that they can be deployed in terms of, you know, they could be fit onto certain aircraft. It could be that could launch from a third party country and then fired over Ukrainian airspace and then turn around again to land in back in Poland or Germany or whatever. And but the damage they can inflict and what they could do in terms of escalation is really dangerous. The ditto with this. So it would have to be the Typhoon system. That would be the only if it's not coming from a U.S. destroyer or a submarine, because that is just that's the big fat red line right there. So if that's the case, what does that entail? And I suppose they feel very confident that they can deliver that. The problem with some of these weapons, though, is we're giving weapons to Ukraine that if we do give them to Ukraine or they're deployed in Ukraine and used against Russia, they're not going to be high end. They're not going to be the top of the line. They can't for various reasons, for the disclosure of technology, should they fall into Russian hands, should they land unexploded, and so forth. That was the case with other weapons that we've supplied Ukraine before. And so I think it's got a lot of problems attached to it. The other thing is Israel is also delivering its old Patriot missile systems to Ukraine right now. I think they've sent the first of eight, the 30-year-old ones, the original Iron Dome batteries. They're now selling or giving to Ukraine. I'm not sure what the deal is there. But that's an act of desperation. Again, it's not top of the range. That's 30-year-old tech. What sort of modified Tomahawk system are they going to give Ukraine? It can't be top of the range. It just can't be. Yeah. So how is it going? And not only that, those missiles are, if they're the old ones, they're really slow.
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
it's when you're going up against Saddam's Republican Guard or a country that has no air defense, fine, you know, shock and awe. But this is Russia. It's not the case. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions with this.
There really are. And listen, I hope this stays in the academic realm, that we don't ever have to actually find out in practicality, because everything bad could happen because of that. But listen, we're going to have to cut it off there, because we got another show here coming up with Jennifer Kavanaugh. But we really appreciate you coming on, especially some of these observations you've made. We, again, will send people back to to 21 Wire. I know you got some stuff coming out. You've already had some stuff come out. Then we recommend people go there and take a look at your Sunday Wire and other shows to see what you may have there. So thanks for coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you, Daniel.
And we appreciate you guys, too. And like I said, just in about 10 minutes from now, you'll be able to see a lot more about what Jennifer Kavanaugh has had to say on this Tomahawk issue, but also several other issues that you're definitely not going to want to miss. Thanks, folks. We'll see you in about 10 minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.